Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
So I have just one quick update for anyone who is around college age or knows someone who is around college age. This summer, we're excited that Brad and Melissa Gibson will be coordinating college events and activities for us. And the first event you can head to is a cookout next weekend. You can meet the Gibsons pretty much any Sunday morning or connect with them at one of the summer events and connect with one another too. And the best way to figure out when these things are is through to join the GroupMe, which you can see the QR code. You can also find information at their Instagram account, CrosspointCarryYA. And all the events and activities will be listed on the upcoming Crosspoint summer calendar that will be on our website. So if you have any questions in the meantime, you can connect with me at community@crosspoint.org. Okay, commercial done. What I want to talk to you about today is a relatively well-known story. If you haven't heard it before, you might have heard its name mentioned somewhere else. It's actually a language learning app is named after it. We tend to say that babies do this before they really learn how to speak. And I want to offer a little bit of context to this ancient story to look at it from a post-colonial perspective and then imagine what implications and challenges it might still hold for us today. So this story wraps up the first 11 chapters of the first book of the Hebrew Bible, commonly referred to maybe as the primeval or the primitive history of Israel, before there actually is something called Israel or the people of Israel or the nation, before God's self-initiated relationship with the man named Abram and later Abraham, which creates this people of Israel. So the story from Genesis chapter 11, it goes something like this. Once upon a time, humanity was of the same mind and the same goals, and everyone spoke the same language, and they were full of hubris, and they wanted to reach God in her heavenly realm and to have access to her whenever they wanted and on their own terms. So, to try to accomplish this lofty goal, humanity began building this enormous tower that reached up to the heavens. God, possibly distracted, busy, or just distant, eventually looked down and took notice of what the people were doing and determined that she did not like it. So God responded to humanity's attempt at accessing the divine with a sort of divine curse. She mixed up all their languages so that when they spoke to one another after that, it sounded like a bunch of babble, and they could no longer communicate enough to accomplish their goal. So humanity, eventually, when they can't communicate, they give up their vision of using architecture to reach the divine, and they disperse across the land. And that is where we get multiculturalism and multilingualism, according to this story. And the legacy they tried to build become known as the Tower of Babel. And the word Babel actually translates to the word confusion. And this interaction between God and humanity in this story, it's actually reminiscent of at least two other stories that come before it in the book of Genesis. First, in the Garden of Eden, the people have been told by God not to eat a certain fruit of the garden. But then they're informed by the serpent that actually, if they do eat it, they would become like gods. Well, who can resist that? And obviously, it wasn't Adam and Eve. And so they eat of the fruit and their eyes are opened. And this did not make God happy. It's also similar to a passage a few chapters later in Genesis chapter 6 that tells us that the sons of God looked down from the heavens, noticed the beauty of the daughters of man, they desired them, and then they came down to earth to have children with them. This also does not make God happy. Apparently, the ancient understanding of this type of divine and human interaction, this pursuit to be equal to the gods, to reach the gods on humanity's terms rather than on the terms of the gods, to be at the same level as the gods, this was a line that was not to be crossed. So the results in the Garden of Eden was the casting out of humanity from the garden. The unsanctioned relationship between the sons of God and the daughters of humans was that this was actually the beginning of the narrative that ultimately has God responding to his frustrations through near extinction of all life on earth, which the gods brought about via worldwide flood, which we now lovingly refer to as Noah and the Ark. But I do want to point out that there's no Sunday school pictures of the people and animals who did not make it onto the boat. It's a conversation for another time. But then you have this Tower of Babel story where when people try to reach the divine, God is not happy. This isn't the only interpretation of the story, though. Here's another one. Once upon a time, after the earth had been flooded and humanity was wiped out and the world repopulated through just the lineage of Noah, people wanted to make a name for themselves. And like they'd done in the Garden of Eden, they sought a type of immortality, but not the type that offered eternal physical life, but that offered eternal fame and legacy. They wanted to be known and remembered. They wanted to be the first thing anyone talked about when they came in the room, and they wanted to be the most important people who ever were and who ever would be. They wanted to go down in the history and the primeval Guinness Book of World Records. So this group of people, they built an enormous tower, maybe to worship the gods, maybe to challenge them. There's some ancient depictions of the tower with a sword protruding from the top, which is indeed a bit threatening. But the people definitely built it without the input or the permission from the gods. And once they completed their mission, they would be unstoppable. They'd be able to do whatever they wished, whenever they wished, and however they wished, and people would be talking about it everywhere. Some interpretations say that as humanity sought to build their legacy, they also were seeking to unify all of humanity into kind of this type of utopia, to be able to exert control of both the heavens and the earth, and to have everyone conform to a certain version of correct living, you know, where they all voted the same and read the same books and dressed the same way. From the vantage point of the tower, those in charge would be able to see who was behaving as they should and who had gone astray. From the vantage point of the tower, those who had strayed could be corrected, could be brought back into the fold. The people in charge who were looking down from the tower could enact rules and expectations for the people below them. And all those looking up at the tower would be reminded of just how hypothetically wonderful and powerful the people above them were, and how lucky they were to be included in something so glorious. The tower was a vision of a world where everyone looked and acted and behaved and believed in the same uniform way. The gods, or God, however, valued diversity and thwarted their plans by scrambling their languages, which had the ramifications of taking away their control and no longer allowing them to see things in the same way. Can't pass out architectural plans if you can't understand them. And in this version of the story, humanity's striving to be more than they're supposed to be. They don't know their role. They are too big for their britches, so to speak. This understanding of the story has been used for justification for all sorts of horrible things in societies. One being limiting of immigration. The argument saying that if everyone comes to the United States and speaks the same language, we are in danger of becoming a Tower of Babel. Therefore, everyone should go back to where they came from. Other arguments, they claim this story for their foundations to declare that cooperation between nations, like the United Nations or the European Union, the EU, that they're the beginnings of one world governments and are taking us closer to being a return to the Tower of Babel, something that God herself did not intend and should be avoided at all costs. But that's also not the only interpretation of this short 9-verse narrative. Once upon a time, the people of the earth were horrible to one another. God got fed up, wiped out creation except for a man named Noah and his family and the animals they put on a large, divinely designed ship. After the floodwaters receded, humanity again began to populate the earth. And this time, because they'd all come from the same ship, they had language and culture and tradition and everything else in common. And although their God had promised that the earth would never again be flooded by divine action, the people were skeptical. So, ancient thought being what it was, they decided to build a large tower to the heavens. The thinking was either, one, if the world were ever flooded again, they could at least climb the tower and be saved. Or two, because of the way they understood that the water came from the heavens, they believed that they needed to build a tower to put some sort of scaffolding up to hold the heavens so that the world would never be flooded again. Or three, there was actually a Jewish teaching that said the people believed that, according to how time was measured, the heavens naturally collapsed every 656 years, and if they could take control of the heavens and drain them before another 656 years rolled around, they would never have to be afraid of rains or floods or the unpredictable wrath or the nature of the gods. And all of these ideas, they're all based really in a mistrust of God. And like the other interpretations, God did not like this and descended from the heavens to thwart their plans by scrambling their languages so they were no longer able to communicate in such a way that they could succeed their task of completing the tower. And all the people became frustrated. They abandoned their common goal. They went their separate ways, which is also the explanation of why we have a multilingual, multicultural world today. One of these is a story about misplaced self-importance. A wish to do things without the assistance of God. One is a story about an overblown focus on the desire for legacy and uniformity and control. And another tells us of a mistrust of the divine to keep their promises. In this case, never to flood the earth again. Which, side note, doesn't, by the way, mean that we were promised that we couldn't do it ourselves through our own misplaced treatment of the world. We're perfectly capable of ending the world without the divine. But these are not wholly bad or even incorrect interpretations of this ancient text. Various scholarship justifies each one to varying degrees of success. It's actually a newer post-colonial understanding of the Tower of Babel story. And interpreted through this lens, it's easy to see that European Christianity has been notorious for trying to build our own type of Tower of Babel, although we wouldn't have called it that. We preferred terms like conversion and missionary movements. And during the height of colonialism, Europe sought to conquer the world, to gain dominion over the earth's natural and human resources. Christian missionaries came along with the colonizers and began to Christianize the lands. The problem with this was that their idea of what it meant to have a relationship with the divine was really like a Tower of Babel. It was a siloed way of thinking that understood that a relationship between human and divine was only possible through a Western, white, Christian context. Missionaries went into countries that were vastly different than their European cultures, and they viewed what they came across not as God's beautiful diversity or a possibility to understand the divine in a new, complex way, but as something to be corrected. And missionaries and colonizers viewed the people from their tower. Where God saw diversity, they saw poor savages that had gone astray and needed to be taught. To them, Christianizing meant whitewashing the nuance of traditional religion and understandings of God. When they said they wanted to make someone Christian, what they really meant was that they wanted to make them act like white Europeans. True Christians all looked and acted and dressed and talked and behaved and worshiped alike. And that was understood as white European. So Christian came to be seen as white, and God came to be seen as white, and everything else was seen as subpar. The results of this type of thinking are disastrous, because to be non-Christian was to be non-European. to be non-European was to be less than human. And to be less than human meant that you were not worth more than what your body could be used for or sold for. This is something that shaped and still affects so many who are affected by European colonization, which is pretty much everybody. Postcolonialism says, however, the divine is diverse and beautiful, and we're able to see more a clear picture of who God is when we take all perspectives. However, it also says that an individual or a people's relationship with God, it's really their business and not ours. And we shouldn't be the one to make determinations or judgments about what that looks like. So, how did you grow up understanding this story? Have you ever even heard it at all? When I read this text through the eyes of scholars and theologians like Barbara Brown Taylor and Sam Boyd and various Jewish Midrash interpretations, there are several things that really stand out to me. First, this really isn't a story about a grumpy God who enacts a divine curse when things don't go the way that they like. In fact, we might argue that what transpires should be seen more as a divine rescue. And when we step back, when we set aside our long-held assumptions and interpretations, when we put the narrative into context, we can see something quite different. These interpretations give vastly different justifications for humanity's desire to build the tower. But the results were the same. People went from speaking and thinking one way of speaking and thinking to multiple ways of speaking and thinking and understanding. But what we can miss when we focus on just the intent of the humans is something that we actually already know and forget. God is a lover of diversity. God's love for diversity is shown through the creation story. We see it throughout the text when God interacts and empowers all kinds of people from all over and includes them in their larger story of love and inclusion. Jesus followed this example in the people that he interacted with. God's creation of language Babel was a rescue of humanity from themselves and a refocus on the beauty that can be found in the other. But while God chose to make humanity beautifully diverse, we humans seem to be constantly pulled back into homogeneity, to uniformity. We are drawn to fortify ourselves with those who look like us, think like us, and believe like us. And we know that the results of this are rarely good, right? It's not a surprise. But what we find is when we think this way, it's why things like white Christian nationalism and hate groups flourish. It's why we had misguided missionary movements and Jim Crow laws that kept us separate but equal. That's why integration was violently fought against. That's why there are hate crimes against Muslims and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders and LGBTQIA friends. That's why we have the suburbs and a lack of investments in cities. That's why there's a fight to ban books and to restrict people's bodies and healthcare. It's why we fear immigration. It's the root of xenophobia and patriarchy. It's the fear of the other, softened using the name of utopia and safety, that pulls us really to just create our own towers of Babel, where we can try to exert control over those who fall out of line when they don't look like us or think like us and aren't willing to conform to what we consider a safe or godly way of existing. But we do it in micro ways too, in how we make snap judgments about someone based upon very little bit information we have about them, or even in our relationships when we seek to be understood more than we seek to understand. But I don't believe this is ever what God had in mind. Unity over all else. I mean, not unity, but uniformity over all else. Because God is a lover of diversity. Second, if this story is at all about legacy, and I have a hint that that might be in there somewhere, it might serve as a warning to us all. We're often told to think about our legacy, and I don't think that's a bad thing. A legacy is something that is remembered and has long-lasting impact, which it makes us ask the questions, what are we going to be remembered for? What are we going to be known for? What are we leaving the people behind us with? Meaning, what type of people are we putting effort into becoming? These are good questions to ask ourselves, especially on a consistent basis. It refocuses us. It makes us ask, what are the most important things to us? I mean, more than just my family and my friends, what is really important to us? Where do we invest our time and our energy and our money? What are we being defined by? Is it by what we exclude rather than what we include? Are we being defined by hate and fear? Is our legacy defined by what we fight against or what we fight for? Are we allowing apathy to define us? The idea that if it doesn't affect me, I'm not going to bother with it. What is our legacy? It's a good question. But let's remember that at the Tower of Babel, people weren't asking themselves those types of legacy questions. They were seeking a legacy of fame. And perhaps this is what we're to remember about this story. And let me pause and say, that's not to say that there's anything wrong with being famous or wanting to be famous. There's not anything wrong with wanting to build a good legacy. But as one rabbi said, what good is legacy when there's a hungry man next door? In other words, what good is our legacy or our systems or our policies or our laws when it becomes more important than, takes the place of, or is at the expense of real people? Theologian, scholar, pastor, author Barbara Brown Taylor offers a little commentary in her book, Holy Envy. She says there's this midrash that expounds on the idea that the problem with the tower building was that it became the singular focus for humanity. It took precedent over everything else, so much so that the tower became so large and so tall that it took a year for people to pass bricks from the bottom of the tower to the top of the tower. Bricks became more important than people. Brick building became an all-consuming social expectation, and anything else was superfluous to the cause of the tower. Actually, when someone fell from the tower because they reached too far and they fell to their death, no one wept. But when a brick was damaged or broken, there was mourning. This midrash goes on to say that a pregnant woman fell from the tower because she went into labor. But she was not allowed to stop making the bricks to celebrate the birth of her child or to rest. Instead, she gave birth, placed the child in her apron, and continued making bricks. Perhaps this is the message of Babel. People are more important. What good is it when our systems and aspirations become more important than people? What good is legacy when those in our country can't afford to live? What good is legacy when it means that what we've created is inequitable, it's harmful to children and bodies, and denies freedoms all under the banner of care for women, children, and families? What legacy are we building when we have built safe places for our kids to go to school and our PTAs throw the biggest parties, but right down the road, other children do not even have school supplies or money for lunches or appropriate shoes for their sports teams? What legacy are we building when we sit by without saying a word while children and adults are not able to get the medical care they need to live as the people God has created them to be? Well-being of individuals, of God's most cherished creation, loses priority, then our legacy becomes nothing more than a bunch of Babel. No, I think that what happened at Babel was not a divine curse. It was the divine's attempt to save us from ourselves. It was a shock to our systems. The creator who created both the blowfish and the woodpecker, the giraffe and bacteria, the entire spectrum of humanity, and so much more, was not interested in all of us being uniform. Diversity is a way to save us from ourselves and our tendency to hunker down around what offers us the least resistance. For when we have many perspectives, when we can put all of those together, we can more closely understand the character and the nature of the divine. We can live more wonderfully with each other and appreciate who we are. We can also begin to realize that we're not the sole centers of the universe. When there's assumed uniformity, we rarely take the time to make sure we truly understand. And so often that leads us to assume that everyone thinks like us, or at least we begin to believe that they should. And that leads to all sorts of problems. Barbara Brown Taylor goes on to suggest that before the divine diversified language, no one had to slow down and explain what they really meant. All of the assumptions were already there. She says, they assumed that they all meant the same thing when they used the same word, which was not the case at all. But speaking the same language had allowed them to cling to that illusion for longer than was good for them. Then God came to their rescue and confused their speech. And when God confused the language, it forced people to slow down, to ask in a different way, to use hands, to ask, would you repeat that, please? It forced people to listen more carefully, to listen differently, to listen before they spoke. It forced us to begin practicing translation. Translation is a unique and complicated science and art form. There are so many words in our languages that have no cross equivalents. We can't have full understanding unless we have them all. So what we have to settle for is whatever's closest to our own when we talk about things. This reminds us that there's more than one way to say something important. This is also the way with our biblical translations. When we read, we have to keep in mind that sometimes what we have in front of us in English is not the full picture, but it's just the best we can do with what we have. Did you know that there's over 7,000 living languages in the world? That over half the world speaks only 23 of them? Did you know that there's a language spoken by only 8 people? Did you know that there's over 300 languages spoken in the United States? Did you know that over half the world is bilingual? Did you know that there's an Inuit word that means the feeling of anticipation that makes you continually go outside to check and see if anyone is coming? I've had that feeling before, haven't you? There's also a word only in Japanese that describes the sunlight that filters through the trees. There's a slang word in Indonesian for someone who tells a joke so badly that is so unfunny that you can't help but laugh out loud. That one was created for all the dad jokes. There's a Hawaiian word that describes the act of scratching your head when you're trying to remember something. There's a Swedish word that's only used to describe the road-like way the moon reflects on water. This list could go on and on and on. English actually includes the most words in its language, but it doesn't have any of those words I just mentioned. So we are actually incomplete in our understanding of the world and of each other and of God. Yes, I think that woven throughout our many interpretations of the Tower of Babel is the truth that God, at her core, loves diversity and variety. And the tower was a threat to that. And thousands of years later, we're challenged to put aside our fears and hesitations and assumptions and embrace that as well. Sometimes that thought makes me mad because there are a lot of people I don't want to have a conversation with right now. There are a lot of people I don't understand. There are a lot of people who are hurting a lot of people. And I want to throw them off the tower, not invite them to dinner. And of course, there was a time to stop talking and a time to take action because the conversation is going nowhere and people are getting hurt and it's time to do something about it. But I also want to remember what Jonathan Sacks said, that the greatest single antidote for violence is conversation. Imagine if we began practicing that. If we began loving diversity the way God loves diversity. What if we practiced unity of spirit and diversity of practice? Let us be reminded that there is more than one way to speak about important things, that there is more than one way to express love, that we should be a people who in our homes and workplaces and schools and neighborhoods and at the grocery store and at Thanksgiving dinner and at our kids' sports game and in the boardroom and in the bedroom and in the living room and on the playground and in our politics and we should be a people who practice slowing down and asking, would you say that again, please? Do you mind explaining that? Questions like these make us pause, make us loosen our control, and help us remember that people are ultimately the most important thing. And when our world and laws don't reflect that, then we should use our voices until it is corrected. Let us practice being those people, because when we do, we can better understand and better reflect the heart and love of God. Let's conclude with some time of reflection. Peace to you as you go.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.